welcome to the Athletic Fantasy Baseball Podcast. It is Friday, July 1st. Derek Van Riper here with Al Melkier live right now on YouTube, as we are most Fridays at 4 o'clock Eastern. So if you didn't catch us live this week, catch us live in a future week. We take questions throughout the show from anybody who happens to drop by at that time. As we do each and every weekend, we're going to focus on a group of hitters and a large group of pitchers that are available in a decent number of leagues as we try and navigate the waiver wire with pickups coming up on Sunday evening. Al, I think this is Vinny Pasquantino week on the podcast and really for fantasy baseball leagues as a whole. In leagues with the first-come, first-serve moves, in leagues that don't have restrictions on players in the minor leagues being added, he's rostered at a pretty high rate. CBS leagues already sitting at 60%. Yahoo leagues, Vinny Pasquantino rostered at 34%. But the NFBC, where a player had to have been drafted or played in the big leagues to have been picked up already, he's available pretty much everywhere. So I think he's going to be one of those very big-bid players in a lot of leagues, especially 15-teamers, but even 12-teamers as well. So we talked about him a little bit earlier in the week. I think the question is, where do you draw the line? How do you stack him up to other first base and corner infield options? And how aggressive are you going to be if you're in some of those fab leagues where Pasquantino's available and arguably maybe one of the last really interesting prospects who's going to get a chance to debut this season?
Well, I think that Pasquantino belongs pretty much everywhere. So in saying that, you know, for me, the cutoff is like 10-team leagues. I know there are folks that, you know, play in 8-team leagues and such. But basically, he's top 10, top 12 at first base. So that, to me, just that really does qualify him for just about everywhere, especially when you take corner infield utility, you take those slots into account. So I think he's one of the last players out there in mixed leagues where I think it's, if you've got that 10% or a little bit more maybe available, you go ahead and splurge. And again, I make that qualification with mixed leagues because obviously with mono leagues, the trade deadline gives us a whole, you know, different kind of bounty there with the crossover players. But I don't think there are going to be too many other players that are going to be worth the kind of splurge that the Pasquantino is worth.
Yeah, so much of the appeal here, of course, is that we're talking about a first baseman who's shown a lot of power in the minor leagues, and he's done it with a low strikeout rate, under 15% at high A, double A, and triple A, draws his walks, has a spot in the heart of this order. I believe he's hitting cleanup on Friday, so first Royals player to do that in about 25 years, if my memory serves me correct from a tweet I saw earlier today. I already forgot who the player was that did it last time. Is definitely not a prospect that hung around and ended up making a long-term impact in the big league. So good bar trivia if you're a Royals fan. But the numbers for the rest of the season, I was looking at the rest of the season projections and I ran them through the auction calculator tool for over at Fangraphs. And it spit out a value pretty close to what you see for Trey Mancini, Jake Cronenworth, Yandy Diaz, Hunter Dozier, Jared Walsh, Garrett Cooper, and Nathaniel Lowe. So Pasquantino's projection was kind of in the middle of that group. Those players were all between about $3 and $5 or $6 based on the settings I had used for a 15-team league. So it would put him just outside the top 20 at the position for now. But when you factor in the corner infield spot, you think about some of the issues we've had with depth at third base this year, that still probably pushes him into that 10-team range that you suggested. So I'm with you in terms of where the cutoff is to roster him. I think the 10% of your budget bid is a fair bid. It might not be enough in the hyper-competitive leagues where prospects like this tend to command a premium. So you have to be kind of mindful of the circumstances as far as how much more it might take. But I think 10% is a great baseline start, and salting the taste based on needs and what your league tends to do is probably the key to coming a little closer to where that final number is going to settle in. Isak Paredes is on the rundown, and I will state for the record, you put him there, not me. I would have put him there if you didn't, but you put him there first. So I know I'm in danger of turning him into my new Victor Robles, my new player that I am obsessed with. But playing time continues to tick up for Paredes in Tampa Bay. He started 8 of the last 9 games going back to Monday, picking up eligibility all over the infield. Some leagues he's got first base, second base, and third base eligibility. And he's showing a ton of power. A 3-homer game against the Yankees last week certainly helps. But how aggressive are you going to be with Paredes in some of the shallow leagues where he's still available? And how does he stack up to someone like Pasquantino for you for the rest of the season?
Well, I made that direct comparison in the waiver column, and I'll get to your question, but one thing I do want to point out is that while Paredes doesn't have the minor league numbers that Pasquantino had at all levels, he was much younger at each level, particularly at high A and double A, as compared to Pasquantino, and he's about a little more than a year younger than Pasquantino. So that's something to just factor in. But that said, I still had Paredes at about half of the bid that I was recommending for Pasquantino, so about 5%. And it's just it is the lack of confidence that I have that this power surge is something that he's going to be able to maintain. Obviously not this level, because when you do something like have three homers in a game and six homers in an eight-game span, we're not ever really talking about that. But just as somebody who's really going to be a player who can move the needle in home runs and RBIs, I don't know that anybody can really know, given how this contradicts the minor league track record. This is not really the player that he was in the minors. He is taking a more aggressive approach than he did in the minors, still making very frequent contact, not walking as much, chasing out of zone pitches a little bit more. So, and not only compared to the minor leagues, but compared to when he was with the Tigers. So you have to do a little bit of guesswork in terms of what type of player Paredes is going to be in the second half, but he is pulling fly balls at an extremely high rate. The only player with at least 40 fly balls who's doing it at a higher rate so far is Mitch Garber. So he's taking a moderate amount of raw power and translating it into big power numbers right now. Whether or not he keeps that going is anybody's guess, but I have the same sort of questions about Pasquantino, and it's a big jump from AAA to the major leagues. So it's not necessarily a gimme that he's going to fall where I'm projecting him or where others are projecting him.
And I think the thing that would make Paredes viable in some shadow leagues where people were previously not interested is that position eligibility, being able to move him around and just simply not lose out on playing time. I think having versatile players like that, you could take a guy whose skills might be fringy for a really shadow league and they play up just a little bit because you can mix and match a lot more. I am curious to see where the hard hit numbers go over a longer period of time. I do think it's encouraging that compared to similarly sized samples in the big leagues over the last two seasons, Isak Paredes is hitting the ball with a 41.1% hard hit rate this season. Previously, he was in the mid-20% range. That's a pretty big difference, and I don't know how much of that is the Rays changing something about his approach, or he maybe changed something in his own approach. I mean, it's a really interesting development. Clearly, someone that they sought out, though, as part of the return in the Austin Meadows trade after the lockout, and a guy that I wanted to see get a chance. Certainly a guy that could have helped the Tigers if they were able to unlock this. And unfortunately for them, he's doing it somewhere else. Let's talk about Derek Hall for a moment, because the Bryce Harper injury opened up a lot of playing time in Philadelphia. And I think at the time that it happened, it wasn't immediately clear who might be the person that fills in most often. It looks like Derek Hall's going to be that player. He's kind of your prototypical left-handed first base DH kind of masher. You know, because of the elbow injury he was already playing through, Bryce Harper was the regular DH for the Phillies. I think he only played like eight games in the outfield all season. So I think this is a skill set that has a better chance of hanging around as a result of what the guy he's replacing was doing defensively. Since Harper couldn't really play defense, Hall's defensive limitations are less problematic. Do you think he's going to hit enough to be an option in more than like 15 team mixed leagues and deeper? Because I think that's the initial cutoff I see for him. But if he's going to stay in the heart of the order, he's at cleanup in back-to-back games, there's got to be a path for a little bit more than that.
Yeah, well, you can also just take that as a sign that the Phillies have a lot of confidence in his ability to do at the major league level what he was doing at AAA Lehigh Valley. The thing that makes me a little bit reticent to really go aggressively after Hall this weekend is that this level of power hitting for him is really new, and he's doing it as a 26-year-old. So he spent two seasons or parts of two seasons at AA Reading, and I am just absolutely incapable of saying the words AA Reading without saying extreme home run ballpark. So the fact that he didn't put up monstrous power numbers in either of his stints there and then goes on to AAA the first year, again, kind of middling power numbers, and then as a 26-year-old, has that click, it does make me a little skeptical that he's going to be able to sustain that, even though he's already had a 2-home run game. So you can be encouraged by that. But I would actually be, position eligibility aside, which is obviously something that Paredes has to his advantage, that all aside, I would rather have Paredes, and having seen what he's done, at least in a short bit against major league pitching, versus Hall, who, again, we've seen this in a relatively small sample at AAA at the age of 26.
Yeah, I think that's all very fair. I would definitely have Hall behind Paredes in a situation where both are available, and there might be some leagues in which I would bid on Paredes but ignore Hall for the time being. I was just very surprised to see where they had him in the lineup, that they didn't just move some more established players up and slot Hall somewhere in, maybe near the bottom third of the batting order. And the run production could actually be surprisingly good if he sticks there. The weirdest thing about this season to me, or one of the weirdest things about this season, has been the way the ballpark in Philly has played, just not as hitter-friendly as it's been in the past, but could change as the weather continues to warm up over the course of the summer. A bunch of outfield-eligible players to discuss on this episode. Andrew McCutchen, who was available in the 15-team Tout Wars Mixed League that I play in, I believe it was 2 weeks ago now, he plays a lot. He's in the heart of that Brewers lineup, usually hits somewhere between third and fifth. Occasionally they'll hit him first or second. And he's only had 2 days off in June. I'm curious if you still see enough in the core skill set for McCutchen to pick him up in leagues where people became impatient with him before this recent hot streak.
Yeah, there are three things that put McCutchen on my radar this week. And one was what you were talking about, just the consistent playing time and the consistent presence in the middle of the Brewers order. Also, the fact that he's had a tremendous month of June, so he's trending in the right direction. And then the third thing, which was the thing that you just alluded to, Derek, which is that the underlying skill numbers are a little worse than they were in 2021. He hit 27 home runs last year, so pretty good power. Nowhere near that pace this year. But really, just the barrel rate down a little bit. Just generally speaking, the indicators seem to be just a little bit off of where they were, but not to the degree where you see the major drop off in power for him. His X slugging is much higher than his actual slugging. So I think that combined, and actually a fourth thing, that the Brewers have a great schedule this week. So I just think it's a really opportune time with him going well, with the X stats showing maybe some untapped production that could be ahead. You know, all of that together, I think, makes it a really good time to add McCutchen. And like you alluded to, he's out there in some 15-teamers, which is a little bit surprising, because you and I have talked about with various players that context can go a long way, even if your surface numbers are just so-so. If you're in a decent lineup, in a decent spot in that lineup, that can go a long way. And McCutchen's already had that going for him.
Yeah, I think if he's going to unlock a little more power this season, it's going to be from hitting the ball on the ground a bit less than he has at this point. 46.2% ground ball rate this season for McCutchen. That would be his highest ever as a big leaguer, and he kind of came close to that back in 2019. That was a season where he was hurt, only played 59 games with the Phillies that season. So that's the one thing in the profile that's a lot different that would give me some pause, but the way he's playing recently makes me think that there's some adjustments being made and he might be working his way out of that. A couple other outfield eligible players that are worth to mention. Ahmed Rosario, I think he's not available in 15-team leagues, but he should be rostered everywhere. He's 71% rostered in Yahoo leagues. That number should be much closer to 100 at this point. And his rest of season value, just bringing it back to the auction calculator I mentioned a bit earlier in the show, based on projections from the BatX, Ahmed Rosario has more projected rest of season value than Carlos Correa and Tommy Edman among a few shortstop eligible players. And I didn't expect to see him projected quite like that, but he really is becoming a do everything sort of player in 5x5 leagues, where maybe power's the one thing where he lags a little bit behind some of the better players at the position.
Yeah, and that's the thing with Rosario. I think sometimes he does get under rostered because he's not going to really open up anybody's eyes in one particular category, but it is that help across the board, like you said, other than home runs. And Rosario is somebody actually I was going to write up in the column this week, probably would have if his roster rate was a little lower, but I think there's room for him to be picked up in some shallower leagues. But if nothing else, if you're in a 10-teamer or even a 12-teamer and he's out there, a very good schedule for Cleveland as well this week. Cleveland and Milwaukee, I think, have the best hitter matchups. And there's three games in Detroit, followed by three games in Kansas City. So not only Rosario, but I think Josh Naylor, Oscar Gonzalez, if he's healthy enough to play next week. Those are also players that you could target this weekend.
Yeah, I would look at Rosario maybe as one of the few players that runs a decent amount that you might be able to trade for. I think a lot of guys that run more than that are almost impossible to get via trade. You're probably not getting 20 bags the rest of the season, but you might get 8 to 10 more, and you're going to get that with a likely very good batting average, pretty decent run production, maybe a tick below average on the RBI front, but all in all, a really nice, well-balanced player, and sometimes players like that get a little bit undervalued in a lot of leagues. You mentioned a few other outfielders, Naylor being among them. I think he's a little bit like McCutchen in the sense that the types of leagues where he pops up occasionally, those 15-team leagues, he should be picked up right away. And he's kind of more borderline for 12-team leagues, but based on where he hits in this Cleveland order, and with the Guardians getting Franmil Reyes back, I think they can take another small step forward as a group, put a few more runs on the board, and I think those counting stats from Naylor and some of those secondary contributors in Cleveland are probably going to tick up just a little bit here over the course of the second half.
Yeah. Now, I think that there's some long-term potential here. I figure, if nothing else, like I say, it's going to be, I think, a very good week for the Guardians offense just because of that schedule. And you mentioned Reyes. Reyes got dropped a lot. So if he's out there, I think he's also one you can target.
It's been difficult to find consistent production in the Oakland lineup, and it sounds like Seth Brown is someone you're looking at. I assume more for 15-team leagues and deeper, though. I mean, he's a cheap barreler who gets a lot of playing time, will sit against some lefties, so I see him as a little bit of a schedule-dependent player, but the underlying skills are actually not bad.
No, they're really not. I like that label, cheap barreler. I don't think I've heard that before, but I think he's a great representative of that category. I will say I am very surprised at the roto value that he's accumulated so far, because he is a batting average liability. He does barrel the ball up, but not, you know, overwhelming power. He does sit against some lefties, like you said. I was very surprised. Where do you think he ranks among outfielders in 5x5 value to date?
Probably in the top 40, because he's doing a little bit of everything. I mean, I had his player page open. The most surprising thing about Seth Brown, he's 7 for 7 as a base stealer. And 7 steals right now through about a half season do a lot of good for your earn value to this point.
Yeah, I think it sort of neutralizes the fact that he doesn't hit for average. And you hit it right on the nose. He is 40th. Among outfielders, I would have guessed top 60, and wouldn't even been totally confident in that. So once I saw that, I actually, in the bidding recommendation, put a little nominal bid recommendation for him in 12-teamers, 0 to 1%, because he's performing as a top 40 outfielder. I don't see anything in the profile. Maybe the steals slowed down a little bit, but I don't see anything in the profile that can't really be sustained. And so you're talking about somebody who clearly does belong in 12-team roto leagues. And you, even at 15-teamers, I don't think you would have to give up very much to get him.
No, it should be a relatively small bid. I think playing time is safe for now. Might not be a player that's on your roster throughout August and September, but at least in the short term, Seth Brown can offer up something to help. 65th percentile in sprint speed, so he's not a burner, but this is a team that can't score, so if you're efficient as a base stealer, you're going to get plenty of green lights. They're not scoring enough runs. That's an obvious problem with the current rebuilding A's. Leody Taveras is back in the mix. Our pursuit of cheap speed never really ends. Is there any reason to believe things could be different this time for Leody Taveras? Currently, really stuck kind of in the bottom third of that Texas lineup.
Yeah, I'm not really seeing it, other than the fact that in a very small sample of plate appearances that he has brought the strikeout rate way down. So I suppose that maybe there's some reason to think that that's something that could be sustained or at least approached, because his strikeout rates in the minors have not been as bad as they've been in the majors. And anytime that you have a player like this who can potentially give you power and speed, much like Seth Brown, without necessarily giving you a great batting average, there's value there to be sure.
I think with Taveras too, the thing I always go back to is that he'll turn 24 in September, and if he had still not made his big league debut, people might be more excited about him than they are as someone who came up and played okay for a little while and then flopped and went back down. I just think that arc does a lot to really hurt our perception of who a player actually is or who a player can become. You look back at his minor league numbers this year, and the K rate's really important to watch there as well. Last season, struck out 24.9% of the time. We've talked a lot about AAA pitching in particular last year being so depleted that that level wasn't quite the test that it's been in the past. 21.7% K rate this year at AAA too, so nice to see some of those gains holding in the early going for Leody Taveras as a member of that Rangers outfield. I think what's really weird about him in terms of his batted ball profile, over time, he has hit the ball in the air a lot more. And I don't know if that's going to be a good thing. We have to see how hard he's hitting the ball. If he hits the ball hard on a consistent basis, then great. He becomes a power and speed threat. If he becomes a fly ball hitter and he's not hitting the ball very hard, then he's going to be a batting average drag and someone that's going to struggle to get on base. And then he's going to be stuck in the bottom of the order and chances to run will be fewer and further between. But still kind of toolsy, still kind of interesting. And that was a league average line at AAA. At age 23, with some power, with some speed, 7 homers, 7 steals before the call-up. So I think in some deeper leagues, if you're looking for help in the outfield, some of those other names we mentioned aren't available, or if they go for a lot of fab and you don't have a lot of fab, Taveras could at least be a decent contingency bid because he's playing right now, and there are still a few interesting things in his profile. Let's move on over to some pitchers. Let's stay in Texas, and let's make a case for someone that you think should be more widely rostered, John Gray. What do you think about John Gray as someone that could be more frequently utilized in some of the more shallow mixed leagues out there?
I think he should be. He has had a tremendous month of June. The CSW, which is, I mean, there's no one stat that you really should rely on, but it's usually the first pitcher stat I go to, because if you're getting whiffs and you're getting freezes, you're avoiding a lot of contact between those two things. And John Gray did that at just shy of a 32% rate over his last 6 starts. So that's phenomenal. I mean, everything in his profile over those 6 starts, the chase rate, the CSW, not giving up a ton of hard contact, like everything that he has done lately has been at a well above average level. And I know, you know, we've seen this from pitchers where they can go 5-6 starts and look like a different pitcher, and then they find their settling point and they think they've been who they've always been. But I think it's worth the shot. And the reason I did include Gray in the waiver column, because I understand that he's not really available in very many 12-teamers. I do think he should be added everywhere now. Instead of an 80% roster rate on CBS, I think it should be at least 95. Instead of I think it's 70% on ESPN, it should probably be about 90. So, you know, for those in shallow leagues, I think this is somebody to go right to waivers and see if he's out there.
Yeah, I think overall, too, the AL West is just not a difficult place to pitch. I think as it stands right now, in the very short term, I don't know the status of Yordan Alvarez for the weekend. I know that scary collision with Jeremy Pena. It could have been worse, like based on what we know so far. Houston's the only team you really worry about right now, even though, yeah, the Angels have Trout and Otani, and Taylor Ward's been great. That's a very top-heavy lineup that they have. I don't think Seattle scares me from a matchups-based perspective. The skills with John Gray look really steady. I mean, leaving Colorado, it's not a surprise that his home run rate is down, actually at a career best right now. And given the circumstances, I'm a little more willing to buy into improvement like that. We know home run rates could be really noisy, especially over a half season's worth of innings, but the core skills actually back this up. I would say part of the appeal for us to talk about a player like this who might be rostered in a lot of leagues, he's a very good trade target. So if you're in a league that allows you to trade, most people play in leagues where you can trade, John Gray could be a sneaky SP2, SP3 type who doesn't necessarily command a price like that in trades right now too. So that's the other angle in which I think you'd want to think about getting John Gray onto your roster. Rich Hill, who was just pitching before we started recording in that Red Sox-Cubs matchup, is coming off of a great June. And you put this question to me. I'm just going to throw it right back at you. How much of that was the schedule? I remember we talked about it a couple times. I know they caught Oakland twice in the last couple of weeks because that put him on our rundown. I think that's part of it. And I guess I'm not really changing my expectations for Rich Hill, regardless of schedule, to be much more than a matchup-based starter for me at this stage of his career. Because there's still a lot of concern on a start-by-start level that he's not necessarily going to pitch that deep into the game, and win probabilities come out slightly low as a result of that.
Yeah. And I'm actually looking at his game log right now, and he really picked up his stats in terms of the peripherals. He had a very good April that didn't include very good peripheral stats. But June, on the surface, you know, it looks like, wow, something really happened here with Rich Hill. But through the whole season game log, he's had, by my count, one really kind of potentially tough matchup. And that was back on April 18th against the Twins. He's had a lot of, he's really, you know, I think June especially, but he's really had a lot of luck with the schedule. But in June, where again, he picked up the freeze rate a lot, the called strike rate, the whiffs went up a little, but still not a very high rate for him. The schedule for him in June was Cleveland, Detroit, Oakland, Seattle, Oakland, Baltimore. Well, Baltimore was the last couple of days of May. But yeah, that gives you an idea. So I was going to write him up until I saw that schedule, and I'm not, it might be legit, but I'm not sure enough to really trust him.
Got a general question here from Star Platinum. I think it's a good time to bring this up. If your ERA and WHIP are near the bottom right now, would you try and save those categories and still make a push, or go out and focus on two start pitchers and just try and move up in wins and Ks when you're playing in a rotisserie league? Are we far enough in where punting ratios, if you're near the bottom, within probably the last three spots of ERA and WHIP, is it time to start giving up on those categories if wins and Ks are more closely clustered and you can gain points there?
In that particular situation, I would say, yeah, I would hate to say punt. Because it is, I mean, we're not even halfway through the season just yet. And that's a lot of standing points to give up. But you may be missing some opportunities in those other categories that you mentioned, wins and Ks. So if it really does, if you're really in a hole in ERA and WHIP, and you have the opportunity to move up the board, you know, maybe move halfway up the board and wins and Ks, yeah, I think that's the move I would make, rather than to try to plug in a bunch of relievers who also can be very volatile and may not help you as much as you think they will. So I just think that the safer move is to go for the bulk innings and try to get the Ks and wins along the way.
Is there a case still to be made in July, though, that if, let's just say you're bottom three in the ratios, but the teams that are ahead of you are not that far ahead of you, do you start thinking about two-start pitchers and mixing in some of the bulk relievers that have been really good? Guys like Michael King, Ronaldo Lopez, Keegan Aikens had a little bit of value like that. Tough thing with Aiken, though, is at a certain point, the K rate's not high enough for some of those relievers where you don't want to use them. But I think Ronaldo Lopez is kind of an interesting glue sort of player right now, where, you know, if let's say you had two pitching spots that you were burning through every week, maybe use one of those a little more aggressively on some of your two-start pitchers, but instead of going to that next level down for another two-start pitcher with really shaky skills, maybe you split it and say, I'm looking for Lopez, I'm looking for a pitcher like that to fill that second spot, because then you're not giving up the ratios, and maybe depending on usage, you're actually still having a shot at getting some wins despite the fact that those guys aren't giving you as many innings.
Yeah, and if nothing else, you could sub them in for your one-start starters. You know, there's different ways to go about that. The one objection that I have to really doing that, it's why I don't really follow that strategy, is because in the past, I do feel like I've gotten burned, because you get to early July and you look at Ronaldo Lopez or Eli Morgan, somebody like that. And things can turn around really quickly when you're looking at somebody who's got 25, 30 innings, maybe 35 even. And that can turn around really quickly. So as opposed to you've got a starter who's had more innings to compile that statistical profile. So if that's really your only route to try to fortify your standing across the board in the pitching categories, I think it's worth a try. But my expectations would not be very high for succeeding with that.
There you have it. But I think it's early enough to punt the ratios if you're really buried there, even though it's still not quite halfway. If you're still within arm's reach of two or three more standings points at each of those categories, I probably wouldn't punt just yet. I think you could consider that again in a few weeks and you know, you'll see it. You'll have a little more information by then. You'll know if you closed the gap, held your own, or if you fell a little further away. That could also dictate the decision along the way. Some more pitchers to get to here as we continue looking for waiver wire targets. Braxton Garrett getting a spot right now in the Marlins rotation. He's had some pretty tough matchups recently. Three consecutive starts where he's been shorter than five innings pitched, but a 22-6 strikeout to walk ratio so far this year in 22 1/3 innings. I think he falls into the tricky two-start pitcher group for this week because he's at Washington and then at the Mets for the second start. I'm curious if you feel any differently about Braxton Garrett.
A little bit more optimistic, and maybe this is a little bit of a tenuous argument to make the case on, but the Mets have not been scoring a lot of runs lately, and just also their overall offensive stats. Like if you look at a measure like WOBA, the past month, they've actually not been that good of an offensive team. So if that could just carry over for another week or so, maybe that's not such a tough matchup for Braxton Garrett. Nationals have been more sort of middle of the pack. Don't really fear them necessarily, but it's not like the Tigers or the Athletics. So I think that the matchups are okay for Garrett. I do think that the two things to worry about is the first thing that you mentioned, which is that he's not going deep into games. So with two starts, maybe you only get 9, maybe 10 innings, maybe no wins out of that. And the other thing is he is giving up a load of contact in the strike zone, which is always something that worries me a lot. But then you look at some other measures like the barrel rate, like average exit velocity on flies and liners, and he doesn't seem to be paying a price for it. So his ERA and WHIP are inflated because of BABIP. Maybe that has a little bit of relation to him not being more deceptive when he's pitching in the zone. But I think there's enough positive there that I would feel okay with going with Garrett, especially in 15-team leagues this week for a two-start stream.
I think he's a little more in the I've decided to punt my ratios group. I'm scared of Braxton Garrett. A little worried the Mets come to life against him. I think that's the bigger concern. The at Nats matchup doesn't worry me all that much. If you could split him, if you're in a daily moves league, throw him out there as a streamer against the Nats, and I think maybe avoid using him against the Mets if you have the option. How would you compare Braxton Garrett to a recent DVR favorite, Dean Kramer, who also has a two-start week this week? He's got the Rangers and the Angels coming up. I just mentioned earlier, I think the Angels are a bit top-heavy with the way their offense is built. They can certainly do damage. Not an easy matchup, but it's also not one that you necessarily have to avoid, especially when it's part of a two-start week.
Yeah, that's close. I didn't include Kramer this week, partly because I included him last week, and partly because what I had written last week was, well, he's had two really good starts in a row that are supported by good peripherals across the board. He's got the Mariners that aren't really they're not a scary matchup. Then goes out, blanks the Mariners for 7 innings. You think, slam dunk for a two-start week. His peripherals in that start were pretty bad. So I think it's pretty close to a push, and I might actually... In fact, I would give Garrett the nod there. I just like what I've seen from him consistently. I know that that Kramer's going deeper into starts, but he just hasn't had consistency in terms of getting whiffs, in terms of getting chases. I just think it could all go very badly.
I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to get something like a 4 ERA the rest of the way from Kramer, a low 4s ERA, and maybe like a 1.20s WHIP, which still... It plays in some deeper leagues. I think he's been fantastic so far, but there's not really much in the underlying numbers that would make you think that you found a total gem. It's just that he's useful, and hey, it's nice to say that about Orioles pitchers.
Yeah,
Justin Steele has been pitching very well lately, piling up a lot of strikeouts, about a strikeout per inning, going back to the middle of May even, 48 Ks to 19 walks during that span, ERA just under 4, pitching really well at home especially, taking advantage of the friendly confines of Wrigley Field. I don't know what to make of Justin Steele overall. He's doing a really good job this season so far, keeping the ball in the park. The season-long ratios are kind of ugly, 4.39 ERA, 1.48 WHIP. Kind of seems like a guy that's really schedule-dependent to me, and I don't care for the schedule for him this week because he's on the road facing the Brewers on the 4th of July. Then he has to go on the road to face the Dodgers for a second start of the week. But do you see enough there to pick him up and not use him for the two-step, but then to roll him out there in easier matchups in the next few weeks? Or do you think he's just more of a watchlist player?
No, I think I see enough there to stash steal. And it's, you know, you mentioned the recent trend. He's pitched a lot of games at home in the last month, month and a half. It's very odd. So he has been better lately. So is it that he does pitch better at Wrigley, or is it that he's pitching better and he just happens to be pitching at Wrigley a lot? I don't know which it is. I just know that he's getting a lot of ground balls, and that doesn't always add up to success. If you're giving up a lot of ground ball base hits, or on the few balls that are lofted against you, they're getting crushed. But yeah, I think with better matchups, that the ground balls for me are kind of enough, you know, enough soft contact there. I know I'd made a recommendation for him in 12 and 15 teamers both, but it was like, it was a nominal bid, and it is more like the kind of situation you talked about. Like, you want that extra start, you want those bulk innings, you cross your fingers, you hope he just gets a lot of ground balls, and that's that. But I'd be lying if I said I was a little bit scared, or more than a little bit scared, for him this week with those two matchups.
Yeah, I think longer term, I have more confidence this season in Steele than Garrett, but I think I like Kramer just a tick more than both of those two guys if you're looking at all three in some kind of scenario. Mitch White, still only around 10% rostered on CBS. I think he's more heavily rostered in NFBC leagues. He's got a two-step this week that will probably spike his roster rate. He's got the Rockies and the Cubs both at home. So, I mean, if I'm looking at this group of pitchers we're talking about so far, other than John Gray, I like Mitch White more than everybody.
Me too. Absolutely. As far as those two start options go, he's obviously a better option, and not that much less available, surprisingly, than at least some in that group. So yeah, we're maybe bearing the lead a little bit here, because he does seem like the one to target.
I thought it was a typo when I saw the roster rate when I was looking those up earlier today. The other pitcher that I think is pretty interesting, because he's probably coming back as part of a doubleheader this weekend, is Luis Patino. He last pitched at AAA Durham on Sunday, had 7 strikeouts in that outing. Obviously, there are some usage concerns just based on how the Rays deployed him last year, but I think the way the Rays use pitchers generally gives us a better chance at either elite ratios, or in some cases, if there's an opener in front of them, better win probability if they're going to go short. I was really interested in Patino back during draft season. I couldn't justify holding Patino on my teams for this lengthy absence without IL spots, but now that he's working his way back, I'm definitely interested again, because I think he might be the kind of guy you could pick up and actually hold on to in a lot of formats.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. Still a lot of upside there. Been a little bit forgotten. Somebody that, you know, I think is worth the spot to stash just to see where it goes.
Got a question here from Benjamin. Thoughts on Alex Cobb against the White Sox tonight? And just Alex Cobb, is he worth being on the roster at all? I mean, I think for me, I still see a good home streamer with Alex Cobb, even though the results this year have been very disappointing. We're talking about a guy with an ERA over 5, a whip up at 146 right now, but a 53-14 strikeout to walk ratio, only 5 home runs allowed in 46 innings. I think there could be a big turnaround coming. Matchup tonight is good enough where I would feel okay about using him if it's at least a 14-team league. And even still, I'd probably think about it in a 12.
Yeah, I would too. Probably not tonight for a 12, maybe a stash, a wait and see, that kind of situation. But I agree that it's a little bit perplexing why Cobb's ERA is so high, why he hasn't been better. And we had a discussion on Thursday's show about pitchers who get a lot of low grounders. It was in the context of talking about Clay Holmes finding success as a closer, but having that in his profile before. Alex Cobb is another pitcher like that, who gets a lot of low grounders, should have a low BABIP. So I'm not sure what's going on there, but yeah, I think that he can miss bats, he can get ground balls, and I think there's a lot that could be good in the second half.
Yeah, velo up quite a bit this season too, almost 2 full ticks on the fastball for Alex Cobb, so I'd be patient with him where you're able to, because I think the second half could be a lot better for him than the first half has been. Thanks a lot for that question, Benjamin. Some schedule-related decisions to think about on the pitching front. Madison Bumgarner's got a two-step this week. We're talking about him in deeper leagues, home against the Giants, home against the Rockies. Luke Weaver has the same matchups, but can't go near Luke Weaver right now. What's your interest level in someone like Bumgarner as a possible streamer with two at home?
Not very high, and I took a closer look at him because of that Rocky start. Anytime you've got a pitcher that are facing the Rockies, and you're facing them in your own home ballpark, that seems like a good thing. But I just, I don't see anything in the profile for Bumgarner that suggests that he might be fine with that start, but maybe not the other one. So I just don't see anything there that suggests there's upside.
This one might be more of a sit or drop sort of question. Ian Anderson has a two-start week this week, home against the Cardinals, home against the Nationals, but he's really become much less of a sure thing to be in your lineup in most mixed leagues over the course of the season. I think that even applies to two-start weeks now.
Yeah. Well, we talked, again, I think this was on the Thursday show, DBR, about Tristan McKenzie and how he's been much less effective now for a string of, I want to say maybe it's 8 starts. And that I'm considering dropping him in a 12-teamer. If I'm considering dropping Tristan McKenzie in a 12-teamer, I am absolutely okay with dropping Ian Anderson in a 12-teamer.
Yeah, with Anderson, I mean, the Marlins got him twice in the last 8 starts. They got 4 runs on him both times. A start at Colorado didn't help the ratios. 9 Ks in that outing, but 5 earned runs allowed over 6 innings. Pitched well in a couple of layup matchups, home against Oakland, road against the Cubs, and then got knocked around in Washington. Only went 4, gave up 4 runs against the Dodgers, struggled with walks in that outing. And then most recently against Philadelphia, he started that game on Thursday, 7 earned runs in just 2 innings. So it's been a really bumpy road for him throughout really the entire season. But it seems like he's become someone you can only use, at least in the short term, in the easiest of matchups. Austin Voth getting a shot with the Orioles, more of an AL-only league sort of mention here. Home against the Rangers, home against the Angels as well. I just wonder if the Orioles can fix him, because there are some interesting underlying numbers with him. I think the pitching plus model that Saras has pointed to Voth as someone who's probably underperformed for a few seasons now. And the Nationals are so bad at developing pitchers that I want to give him a clean slate. I want to see if just working with new coaches in a new organization might actually make him useful. All that being said, I don't know if I'm doing anything with Voth outside of the deepest of leagues right now.
Yeah, not 15-teamers, sure. AL only, where anybody who's got a rotation spot is fair game anyway. Maybe there's something that the Orioles can do there, but yeah, not interested in mixed leagues.
Keep an eye on him, though, because I think the visceral ugh reaction to Austin Voth might be inappropriate now that he's in a new organization. Nick Lodolo should be back from the IL. 2 starts against the Mets, against the Rays, both at home. A very difficult challenge for him for a 2-start week coming off the injured list. Where you might have him already or where available, how interested are you in picking him up and then using him right away given these matchups?
Picking him up in 15-teamers, if he's available, yes. Starting him this week, nope. And I'm not all that worried about those matchups. If I'm going to give, Braxton Garrett a little bit of a pass for facing the Mets, then I could do it here too. But I want to see how Lodolo does in those matchups before I use him. So if it's a league where I have to use him, I suppose maybe I take my chances just because I'd like to roster Lodolo and just see how it goes, but I'd rather not start him this week.
A few other names that I just felt were worth mentioning looking at the matchups. Johnny Cueto's got 2 starts this week. He's got the Twins and the Tigers. I think if you're taking him on for both of those turns, it's because of that latter opportunity. I don't have Cueto anywhere, and maybe that's a bit of a mistake. He's got a 45-13 strikeout to walk ratio in 54 innings. A little bit of a home run issue, but he's getting deep into his starts. He's gone 5+ in all of his appearances so far this season. I guess I would say if you're using and occasionally rostering Jose Quintana, guys like that, then Cueto should be kind of part of that rotation for 2-start weeks in certain matchups. I mentioned the Eno pitching model a little earlier. The pitching model does not believe in what Cueto's doing at all. It's all location and pretty much no stuff at this point in his career. but Martin Perez grades out almost identically in the model. So it gives you an idea just of whether or not maybe it's smoke and mirrors or someone just being really precise with command and getting away with it. I don't know. Like I didn't realize Cueto was pitching nearly as well as he's pitched to this point. So I think he's at least a consideration with a two-start week.
He is. He is definitely a consideration, not somebody that I thought made the cut in terms of getting into the column where I did write about Braxton Garrett and a lot of the pitchers that we've talked about here, Justin Steele. But yeah, I mean, the peripherals are decent. It's interesting because as you were talking about 1 second before you said Martin Perez, that's where my thinking was going in terms of a comp. But the thing is that Perez does get a lot of grounders, a lot more grounders, more soft contact in general. So at least there's something there I can hang my hat on and say, this is why he's going so deep into starts. This is why he's getting so many quality starts. I feel like it's an even smaller margin of error for Cueto. He can get it done, but I think the probability of him doing it in any given start is less than for somebody like Perez.
Yeah, it scares me, but someone I wrote off completely who has exceeded my expectations. Aaron Civale, who has just been brutal so far this year, tempting to try and stream him against the Tigers, especially because last time he saw them a few weeks ago, it was 6 1/3 scoreless innings. But the season numbers are awful. The velocity is down for the season, and Civale is giving up more hard contact than ever. So I see more bad in these underlying numbers than good, and that actually gives me some pause. I don't think I want to stream Civale in a spot where I would stream almost anybody against that Tigers offense.
Yeah, and I'm laughing because that's pretty much exactly what I was thinking when I was checking it. I was like, oh, Tigers. One of the things I do when I prepare for the column and also just doing research in general for this week and thinking of who to target, who's pitching against the Tigers? Who's pitching against Oakland? Who's pitching against Arizona? Looking at some of those teams, the bottom, Pittsburgh, and seeing who's facing them as one-start pitchers. I saw Civale took one look, and I just said, absolutely not. Does not make the cut there.
No, and I think that paired with Cal Quantrill's underlying numbers, strikeout and walk rates, not looking great for him. I could see the Guardians going young in that rotation and maybe giving Daniel Espino a shot before season's end. I mean, just replacing Civale outright would probably be one path, but they could have another starter trending in the wrong direction sooner rather than later, and I think they've got the young talent in the system to try and just replace them internally. You've been a little more into Chad Kuhl than I have been pretty much all season. He's at Arizona, and I think increasingly he might end up being a sneaky trade target for contending teams looking for a back-end starter just to chew up 4 or 5 innings at a time throughout the second half. But are you trying to pick up Kuhl and start him as a streamer this week in this matchup?
Definitely like that a lot better than Civale against the Tigers. Yeah, there's something there with Chad Kuhl. And one thing that I do like about him is if he ever does get out of Colorado, that I think he could be one of these low BABIP, low whip guys, because he does just get a lot of high fly balls, a lot of easy outs that way, even if he's just, you know, not a very good strikeout pitcher. So yeah, for a matchup like that, probably not 12 team, but 14, 15 team, I'd be fine going with Chad Kuhl.
A 2023 Oakland A, Chad Kuhl. He'll be up there leading the rotation along with Paul Blackburn next season. That's how it's going to go down. One other name that I think is kind of interesting on the starting pitching front, with Zach Eflin on the injured list due to that knee injury, Bailey Falter has been pitching really well at AAA. Arsenal's not bad. It's a home matchup against the Nationals, and I think the way that Park is playing makes me a little less scared about using fringy Phillies pitchers at home. So I think Falter's kind of in the same tier as Chad Kuhl right now, as someone that could surprise you with the number of innings you get, the resulting number of Ks, and the possibility of a win when the right matchups come around.
Yeah, it sounds about right to me. Yeah, I definitely think he'd be a good player to stash, and think that he could, over the second half, if he gets opportunities, be not 12-team relevant, but you know, deeper, I think could be somebody that you probably start more often than not.
Let's go to the closer carousel. The big news of the week, of course, Kenley Jansen going back on the injured list due to an irregular heartbeat, which has happened to him before. And based on the reports we've seen so far, they're expecting Jansen back in a few weeks. It's scary, but fortunately, it's not as bad as it could be. it leaves Atlanta in a position to either split saves between AJ Minter and Will Smith, or possibly turn the job over to one of those guys outright, or to go somewhere else. They've got plenty of interesting relievers to choose from. So I'm curious, if you're looking for saves in the Atlanta bullpen, when pickups run this weekend, who are you most likely to go after?
It would definitely be Minter, but I'm not going to really bet a bit aggressively on him or anybody else in that bullpen, because Jansen may not be out that long. There may be a limited number of opportunities to go around in his absence. And I don't really know how to read the usage in the last few days, because you saw Minter pick up a save, and then the next day you saw Smith pick one up, but Minter had also pitched three times in the previous 4 days. So that is a very plausible explanation for why Smith got the call. But we can't know for sure. So they both seem like they'd be viable options. If it was Minter's job to run with while Jansen's out, I'd be a little bit more interested, but I have a feeling I'm not going to be able to compete with people who see something more in that situation than I do. So I'm probably not going to bid very high.
Yeah, I think you're bidding for 2 to 3 weeks worth of saves, potentially, if you are going after Minter. He's the Atlanta reliever I'm the most interested in the short term. I think he went for 15-16% of a full budget in our Thursday night league that we talk about a bit on this show. Are we too early to start stashing the possible next closer up options in places where we think someone's going to get traded at the trade deadline? So an example of that could be Baltimore. Jorge Lopez, we talked about him on yesterday's show. He's been very good. Is it too early to pick up Dylan Tate at this point?
I don't know if Tate is the guy. We talked about him on Thursday's show. I think if he did get the chance, he could be very good. So you could probably bid a dollar or bid nothing if you're in a league where you could bid nothing and get Dylan Tate. So I don't see a lot of harm there if you have the room to stash him. I don't think, to answer your first question, it is definitely not too early. It is July now, and you need to get out ahead of these transactions before they happen. And you could see closers starting to be traded. It's not all going to happen at the end of the month. You know, some could happen in a week or two. So yeah, I think now is absolutely the time to start speculating.
You'll definitely save a lot in terms of fab if you make those moves now, as opposed to after the time when things actually change. Now, in shallow leagues, we talked about Paul Sewald a few times. I was just looking at the June leaderboard for saves. Sewald had 6 saves in June. So you got to think about him in some of those smaller leagues where he's somehow been left on the wire, because even though they go committee in Seattle, he seems to have a large share of those opportunities for the time being.
Yeah, and I also just like his profile the best, too. So, I figured at some point it was going to come to that with Sewald, although he hasn't been as good as he was last season. So I figure if we had the 2021 version of Paul Sewald, he would just kind of run away with the job. But I do think that he's somebody that needs to be added. And to me, that would be much more worthwhile than going after AJ Minter.
The other stash name, if you're playing the long game, this is pretty interesting only because of someone I play in a league with who made the move, Yerry De Los Santos. If you believe that the Pirates would trade David Bednar, which for the right deal, I'm sure they would. Like, the multi-year control reliever that's that good is going to bring back quite a bit of long-term value. Then De Los Santos could be the stash that you actually want to have in Pittsburgh, because they will have him for a long time. He could step up and take on that opportunity. Good fastball, good slider. Just seems like a solid two-pitch reliever with pretty good command as well. And not a guy that people have thought a lot about. So just the name to file away, especially in keeper and dynasty leagues. Easy, cheap pickup now or even a couple weeks from now, and maybe someone that emerges for a more prominent role in the second half if Bednar is among the players moved. I'm really excited for the trade deadline. It's on Tuesday, August 2nd this year, so we've got just about a full month before we actually get there, and I think we're going to see, maybe with expanded playoffs, a little bit more aggressiveness from mid-pack teams, just trying to make themselves better, and that's going to create more playing time opportunities for sellers as a result, and shift playing time around in a way that we can all hopefully take advantage of in our fantasy leagues.
Yeah, no, I think it's I would like to see that certainly from a fan's perspective, but also I think it makes our job a little bit easier at this stage because you mentioned the Orioles situation, you mentioned the Pirates situation. So there's a really finite number of teams who are clearly out of it and clearly going to be sellers at this point. So, you know, maybe a team like the Marlins or the Rangers, you know, wind up selling, but you know, those teams that you mentioned clearly are. So you can focus now on those teams that are clearly out of it and makes it a little bit easier than in past years.
If the Orioles were in a different division, I think things might look a little bit different. Mm-hmm. They're 7 below 500 right now at 35-42. Nice step forward for them. But they're 21 games behind the Yankees. I mean, that's just part of the problem right now. Yankees, Jays, Red Sox, and Rays are so good. The Orioles only 6 back of the Rays right now in that division. So
yeah,
a step forward for sure, but nothing that would prevent them from trading someone like Jorge Lopez if the right offer came along. I look at teams like Oakland and think, like, oh, who are you actually going to trade? I mean, maybe it's enough to open up a spot for AJ Puck, like we suggested last week. The Royals could move some relievers. That could open up some spots for different guys that we've liked in that pen for a long time. So looking forward to seeing how it all plays out here over the course of the next month. We have to go, but if you do not have a subscription to The Athletic, it's a good time to get one. $1 a month for the first 6 months at theathletic.com/fantasybaseballpodcast. You can check out Al's waiver column, which goes up each and every Friday. We get some updated rest of the season rankings that just dropped. I think our fantasy football draft kit actually went up earlier this week. So if you play that, you can start digging into that content. And of course, if you're like a basketball fan right now, free agency is happening, big transaction frenzy there. All coverage under one bundle for just $1 a month for the first 6 months. TheAthletic.com/fantasybaseballpodcast. Find Al on Twitter at AlMelchiorBB. Find me at Derek Van Riper. The Athletic Fantasy Baseball Podcast returns on Tuesday. Have a safe and happy holiday weekend.